Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 80 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or join the discussion there. Follow us on Twitter, at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes, Podbean, and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. And a reminder that you still have a chance to win the book from the last show, number 79. Addiction is Not a Disease is the subtitle of that book. You just need to send in the best comment of the week. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others of your ideas. The feedback of the week is from Mark Lewis, who was the guest on The Infectious Myth number 79. After he listened to the show, he said this: "I like it very much, David. The conversation was thoughtful and we explored areas that I don't usually get into. So thank you for your excellent questions and your responsiveness to my own responses. I'm glad we had a chance to do this, finally. Let me know if you get any interesting feedback." Well, write some interesting feedback and we'll also read that on the air. It did take a long time to get Mark as a guest, but I'm glad I did. It was an interesting discussion. This week I won't have a guest. I will be talking about some of the items in the news. This is unfortunately flu vaccination season, despite the fact that the vaccine's never very effective, and it does have side effects. Here on our television station from Texas, KUTV, is a news item. A fourth grader from Crystal Beach, Texas, has been in a hospital bed since October 17th, when she suddenly became blind and paralyzed, CNN reports. Her parents say she got a flu vaccine 2 days before her health began deteriorating. 8 hours after the shot, her parents say she was vomiting profusely. By Saturday, she was paralyzed from the waist down and blind after an apparent seizure. Dr. Umair Shah, the executive director of Harris County Public Health and Environmental Services, says flu shots are extremely safe and encourages everyone over the age of 6 months to get one. There are some cases, very rare, that a flu shot has a more serious reaction, Shah said. Well, I guess he's right. Sometimes there are flu shots that have more of a reaction. And who knows how rare it is, because often parents don't report these reactions or doctors claim that they're not related to the vaccine. Another vaccine article was October 28th in the Washington Post. And this was one of the Washington Post writers writing about her own experience. She said that she developed severe shoulder pain after a pneumonia vaccine. She blamed this not on the vaccine itself, but on the nurse injecting it too high in the arms. She quotes an orthopedic surgeon at the University of Pennsylvania saying, "I've seen more than a dozen patients who have suffered shoulder injuries after vaccinations." She also quotes several anecdotes of people who've experienced similar side effects. The vaccine court in the United States has received 1,200 complaints of this type of side effect and has awarded over $100 million in compensation for what they call SIRVA, even though it's not on the list of admitted vaccine injuries, but the writer says that it may soon be added as one of the recognized vaccine injuries. And the importance of this is that supposedly if you walk into the vaccine court with an injury that's on their list of recognized side effects, then you get automatic compensation. If it's not on the list, then you have to fight for it. But the fact that they've received so many complaints and have awarded so much money in compensation makes it likely that it will get at it in a fair world anyway. Although in the world of vaccines, there's no such thing as fairness. For myself, the only vaccine I've had in probably 30 years was a yellow fever vaccine that I thought I needed to travel between Nigeria and India on business. After the vaccine, for several months, I experienced muscle pain in my left arm, and I exercised regularly with weights, and it hurt every time I lifted weights. At first, I had to reduce my level of exercise. Now, this is clearly not a serious side effect, and I'm not saying it is. But it was a side effect, and it persisted for several months until it gradually subsided. The Washington Post writer, to get back to her, of course, went back for another flu shot this year and believes it didn't cause problems this time because it was lower in her arm. I guess she's never going to learn. Helen Lauer, a professor of philosophy at the University of Ghana, who we have had on this show before, wrote to me to say that there has been what she says is an astonishing outing of the truth today on BBC News about Ebola. Of course, the report clip was only broadcast once, but I heard it clearly. And this is what she heard. Reporting from Connaught Hospital in Freetown, Sierra Leone, the BBC World Service News, it's November 5th, 2015, Global Health Reporter divulged that the figure of 11,300 lives lost to Ebola was dependent upon the use of 14 different tests throughout the region, since none of them were regarded as reliable. Even while awaiting the WHO's final clearance declaring that the outbreak is over, research is still in progress to find a test for Ebola. I guess somebody must have thought about this and realized that this wasn't appropriate for the news, because it really calls into question the whole Ebola so-called epidemic. If there's no test for Ebola, then there's no such thing as Ebola. And given that the symptoms of last year's Ebola epidemic were significantly less significant than the 1970s symptoms, when it was actually a hemorrhagic fever where people were bleeding from multiple orifices, whereas in this last epidemic, just having a fever and a cough and a positive test was enough. But of course, if the positive test is not meaningful, then the whole definition of Ebola falls apart. Staying on the issue of medicine, getting back to mefloquine, and also called Larium, on November the 8th, the UK newspaper Daily Express reported, the UK Ministry of Defence was under pressure to abandon its use of the controversial anti-malaria drug Larium last night, after a recent study published in the Journal of the Royal Navy Medical Service. Military doctors revealed that more than half of 111 troops given Larium reported adverse reactions. Worryingly, this figure rose to 100% in women. More than 1 in 10 were forced to stop taking the drug and switch to a more expensive alternative. They also reported that a national, that's UK, pharmacy chain Lloyds has barred its medical experts from prescribing the drug because of its, quote, unpredictable side effects. And there's a lot of talk about mefloquine Larium in the UK right now, because there will be a parliamentary inquiry. So I'm sure I will be providing you with updates on this. Now to the issue of the justice system. Romeo Filion died on November the 2nd. You've probably never heard of him, but he was the man who served the most time in Canadian prisons for conviction that was later overturned. In 1971, he confessed to a 1967 murder. Filion was a target because he was a petty criminal and con artist. He had, for example, at one time been alleged to have pulled a shotgun on a taxi driver and was involved in robbery and prostitution. He was also gay, which probably didn't help. Filion was a suspect in 1967 at the time of the murder, but police knew that he was 237 kilometers away at the time of the murder. I think it's about 150 miles. This fact was hidden from the defense and only came to light in the late 1990s. By my calculation, that's about 30 years of hiding this fact. When his gay lover, Neil Miller, told the police that Filion had told him he had done the murder, the police brought him in and he confessed. Nobody knew if it was a joke gone wrong a way to impress his lover, or perhaps because he feared what the police would do to Miller if he offered to him this confession and it turned out to be some kind of a joke on the part of Miller. Even after this came to light, it took 6 years for the Ontario Court of Appeal to overturn Filion's conviction. But rather than acquit him, they simply granted him a new trial. The prosecution then dropped the charges, so he was never legally determined to be innocent. He launched a lawsuit against the police and the prosecutor, but they fought back, and he died before his lawsuit could be heard. It's not known if it will proceed on behalf of his estate. Filion did not have an easy time growing up. It wasn't just that he was in a large, poor family, but his father was abusive. When his mother was in hospital having yet another child, his father sent him and his twin away to a school run by the Brothers of the Christian Schools, which was later found to be notorious for physical and sexual abuse. These facts came out during a lawsuit by former residents in the early 1990s. Filion even received $50,000 in compensation. Filion, however, was often his worst enemy. He walked out of a minimum security prison in 1990 and immediately walked into a bank, told the teller he had a gun, he didn't, got $2,000, and took a taxi back to the prison. His comment on being convicted to 4 years, concurrent with his life term, was, "It's nice to be doing time for something I'm actually guilty of." Filion really wanted to do one thing when he got out of jail, to see the CN Tower that has dominated the Toronto skyline for years, since 1976 to be exact. But Filion had been in jail for so long, he was the only person from Toronto who'd never seen it. Despite everything, he did eventually get out to see it. His case was brought forward by the Canadian Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted, led by James Lockyer, who has been doing marvelous work in this area in Canada for many years. Slate magazine on October 29th had an article, "Crime Lab Scandals Just Keep Getting Worse," by Delia Lithwick. The article says, "Perhaps the most dramatic example of a massive scandal that cannot seem to be reversed involves Annie Duquesne, a chemist who worked at a Massachusetts State Lab Drug Analysis Unit. Duquesne was sentenced in 2013 to at least 3 years in prison after pleading guilty the year before to having falsified thousands of drug tests. Among her extracurricular crime lab activities, Duquesne had failed to properly test drug samples before declaring them positive, mixed up samples to create positive tests, forged the signatures, and lied about her own credentials. Over her nine-year career, she tested about 60,000 samples involved in roughly 34,000 criminal cases. 3 years later, the state of Massachusetts still can't figure out how to repair the damage she wrought almost single-handedly. By the close of 2014, despite the fact that there were between 20 and 40,000 so-called Duquesne defendants, depending on whether you accept the state's numbers or the American Civil Liberties Union, fewer than 1,200 had filed for post-conviction relief, presumably a reduction in the sentence or the overturning of their sentence. Many of them were sentenced under plea agreements rather than at trial, and they feared that a re-examination of their case could potentially lead to even longer sentences. So the ACLU of Massachusetts stepped in last spring to ensure that no defendants would face harsher penalties if they challenged their Duquesne evidence. So in other words, if their Duquesne evidence was thrown out, the prosecution couldn't go find some other evidence or change their case and ask for an even harsher sentence. In May, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts unanimously ordered that each of the defendants whose guilty pleas were based on Duquesne's evidence could seek new trials without facing added charges or stiffer sentences. The state court stopped short of ordering each of the convictions vacated, which is what the ACLU was asking for, but they effectively capped any defendant's sentence to what it would have been under the original plea agreement. So that could be 20 to 40,000 people in Massachusetts getting out of jail earlier or getting out of jail right away because of the actions of one crime lab worker. She's not the only one. Also in Massachusetts, Sonia Farrick, who was addicted to drugs, not only stole her supply of drugs from the evidence room, but also tampered with samples and performed tests under the influence, thus tainting as many as 10,000 or more prosecutions. Farrakh used cocaine, crack, or methamphetamines daily or almost daily while at work, as well as ketamine, MDMA, ecstasy, phentermine, amphetamines, LSD, and marijuana. She also pleaded guilty and served 18 months behind bars. It's actually amazing how light a sentence is for somebody working within the judicial system versus somebody caught on the street with those drugs. But in April, Massachusetts highest court found that state law enforcement officials had never fully investigated the scope of Farrakh's wrongdoing, retesting only 10 samples of her work. And based on new discoveries by defense lawyers, the extent of her drug abuse now appears far greater than was initially alleged. Officials at the time of Farrakh's arrest claimed that she had tampered with the drugs she tested beginning only in July 2012 and only after she had tested each sample. That is now in serious doubt. The New York Times on October 20th published The Strange Case of Anna Stubblefield. I found this a severely depressing article that I'm sure you'll understand as I read this. Anna Stubblefield told the family of a severely disabled man that she could help him to communicate with the outside world. The relationship that followed would lead to a criminal trial. At first, when this professor, Anna Stubblefield, started working with this family's severely disabled son and brother, they were really happy in using a technique called facilitated communication. She claimed that she was able to help him communicate with the outside world, and it appeared that he was writing messages that all these years they had thought him to be mentally disabled. It appeared that this was not true. But then came the night when Anna took hold of DJ's hand, and this disabled man is referred to as DJ. "We have something to tell you," they announced at last. "We're in love." "What do you mean in love?" the family asked. So the family was now shocked and called into question this whole technique of facilitated communications. So what happens is that somebody who claims to be able to use facilitated communications holds the hand or the arm of a disabled person, and then through this they can operate a keyboard or probably a virtual keyboard on a screen, and then they can type messages. This appears to mean that people who have been unable to communicate have been assumed to be mentally deficient when they weren't, and that actually within them is a perfectly intelligent person. However, there are people who don't agree with this. So to go back to our story, at the request of DJ's family, Anna Stubblefield began to work with him. Starting with her hand beneath his elbow, she helped him point at pictures and then at letters, and eventually at the buttons of a Neo, a handheld keyboard with a built-in screen. With his hand in hers, she helped him type out words after 30 years of silence. The family had been thrilled with DJ's progress, but now suddenly they recoiled. Anna, on the other hand, had a husband and two children and wanted to leave her husband to be with DJ. At the peak of facilitated communications popularity, the New York Times writes, a workshop could draw 1,000 people. By October 1991, the technique had actually made its way into the New York Times in an article that began with a boy in Syracuse who was thought to have an IQ of 37 until he started using facilitated communication. He received a standing ovation when he graduated from high school. 3 months later, Diane Sawyer did an Emmy-winning segment on the method for Primetime Live on ABC. "For decades, autism has been a dark mystery," she told her viewers, "a disorder that seems to turn children in on themselves against the world. Tonight, however, you are going to see something that has changed that. Call it a miracle. Call it an awakening." Facilitated communication arrived in the United States during a time of hysteria over child sexual abuse fueled by memories recovered during hypnosis or elicited from children. By the end of 1994, some 60 users of facilitated communication had made claims of sexual abuse. As these cases multiplied, some researchers began to look more closely at whether facilitated communication could be trusted. When Betsy Wheaton, an autistic 16-year-old from Maine, typed out that her father makes me hold his penis, Shane, a professor brought in to evaluate her, arrived with a battery of tests. First, he showed Wheaton and her facilitator, a speech and language trainer, a set of pictures, a shoe, a spoon, a ball, and asked Wheaton to identify them. In some cases, Wheaton was shown the same pictures as Boynton. In others, she was shown different ones that Boynton wouldn't see. No matter which she saw, the results were the same. Wheaton spelled out whatever was on the pictures shown to Boynton. So in other words, the person doing the facilitated communication was in control, apparently, based on this experiment. This case, ironically, is the opposite. Anna Stubblefield claims that through facilitated communication, DJ, this disabled 30-year-old man, asked to have sex with her, and so she complied, and eventually they were able to have sex. She reports that DJ was very happy with what was going on, she said in court. If he needed to say something, he would bang the floor, and she would pause to set him up with a keyboard. It was a few hours from getting undressed to afterglow, she said. When they were finished, he typed, "I feel alive for the first time in my life." Of course, that's what Anna Stubblefield said, he said, based on facilitated communications, but the court did not agree. Anna said, "DJ wanted to be physically involved with me, and I wanted to be physically involved with him. Our relationship is not just about or primarily about the sex part. We love each other very, very much, and I wouldn't have sex with somebody that I didn't love." She went on trial for 2 counts of first-degree aggravated sexual assault, the same charge that would apply to someone who had inflicted severe injury during a rape or participated in a violent gang rape. The state set out to prove that DJ was incapable of consent to sex or physically helpless to resist it, and that Anna either knew or should have known. DJ went to court only once, presented by the prosecutor as a demonstrative exhibit. His mother led him in, holding up his tiny frame at the armpits. She walked him down the aisle and over to the jury, as his head rolled back and his eyes seemed to focus on the ceiling lights. "Jury, this is my son," she said. Then she turned DJ to face the judge. "Your Honor, this is my son." If DJ spotted Anna in the courtroom, it would have been the first time in 4 years. He did not react. Anna's lawyers later argued that the prosecutor tried to block her from his view so DJ wouldn't reach for her as he used to. The jury found Anna guilty on both counts. She could be facing 10 to 20 years for each of the 2 times that she and DJ had sex. The prosecutor had asked for the punishments to run consecutively. Anna Stubblefield is appealing the conviction. "I feel deeply saddened by this whole situation. Possibly it's because innately it seems absurd to me that a woman could be accused of aggravated sexual assault, as opposed to a man who holds a knife at a woman's throat, drags her into the bushes, and violently assaults her. This seems quite different, and yet, logically, it's a very similar situation. I lean towards facilitated communication being a self-delusion and one that, as we can see through this article, can produce harm. I remember when I was a teenager, an experience with a Ouija board. It was something I couldn't explain. We all supposedly closed our eyes and put our fingers on the Ouija board, and it spelled out a sentence that said something like, 'David will marry Gwen.' Gwen was one of my classmates. I didn't end up marrying her, by the way. But it seemed to me that the curse had moved of its own volition. maybe somebody was intentionally doing this, or maybe this was a thought that somebody had had, and somehow this came out on the Ouija board. It seemed like magic, but I wanted to be a rationalist and explain it somehow, but it's hard to explain, and these things can be very convincing. Nobody really knows what's going on inside DJ's head. Perhaps he is completely and utterly disabled. Perhaps he did like having sex at the level of which he could comprehend it, or perhaps he didn't. Nobody can really know except through the mechanism of facilitated communication, which the court rejected. The court and the family are basically saying that it would be illegal for DJ to have a sexual experience because he's incapable of expressing his desire to have sex or not. I feel that Anna had a big responsibility, but I also feel that if people are promoting facilitated communications and it really doesn't work, and one of the things it says in the article is that the promoters of facilitated communications are very reluctant to actually have it tested in a way that could prove whether it worked or not. These people also have a big responsibility. I sense that Anna Stubblefield had no intention to do anything wrong, but was caught up in what might be just a terrible delusion. Sticking with the subject of the justice system and sexual assault, the Associated Press has uncovered the fact that about 1,000 police officers in the United States have lost their badges in a 6-year period for rape, sodomy, and other sexual assault. Sex crimes that included possession of child pornography or sexual misconduct such as propositioning citizens or having consensual but prohibited on-duty intercourse. They state that they believe the number is unquestionably an undercount because it represents only those officers whose license to work in law enforcement were revoked, and not all states take such action. California and New York, with several of the nation's largest law enforcement agencies, offered no records because they have no statewide system to decertify officers for misconduct. And even among states that provided records, some reported no officers removed for sexual misdeeds, even though cases were identified via news stories or court records. On November 3rd, the Associated Press continued with another article that found that law enforcement officers accused of sexual misconduct have often jumped from job to job and at times faced fresh allegations that included raping women because of a tattered network of laws and lax screening that allowed them to stay on the beat. Some officers are permitted to quietly resign and never even face decertification. Others are able to keep working because departments may not be required to report all misdeeds to a state police standards commission, or they neglect to. Agencies also may not check references when hiring or fail to share past problems with new employees. One of these cases was reported in a November 7th story jointly by Raw Story, Guardian, and Associated Press. Oklahoma managed to come up with an all-white jury for a policeman accused of raping several black women and teens. Maybe this won't prevent a conviction, assuming the evidence is there, but judging by this Raw Story article, there is evidence from multiple witnesses. His youngest accuser said she was 17 when he raped her on her mother's porch after groping her, ostensibly to search for drugs. Another witness testified that Holtzclaw sexually assaulted her during a late-night traffic stop in June last year, in which she feared for her life. She said that he unzipped his pants, took out his penis, and told her, "I just got off work. I'm tired. I don't have all night." Another disturbing story regarding sexual assault is the story of NFL star Greg Hardy and his attack on his ex-girlfriend, Nicole Holder. As reported in Deadspin on November 6th, he was convicted of an assault which, among other things, saw her thrown against a tile bathtub wall, tossed on a futon covered in assault rifles, and choked until she told him to kill me so I don't have to. He was convicted, but then the charges were dismissed on appeal because Holder, his ex-girlfriend, disappeared and could not be found, and then the record was expunged. Her disappearance was probably because she received a major payoff, major monetary settlement, so this valuable football player can now return with no charges on the record. In case you think that the appeal means there was no evidence, the Deadspin article includes the police photos of the bruising over much of her body. There was also a witness who testified to hearing a body being slammed for several minutes. The police have to be given credit for persistence because at first Nicole refused to talk to the police who encountered her running out of the apartment building. She said she fell down the stairs, which is kind of a cliche with battered women who don't want to get involved with law enforcement. But then later she opened up. She explicitly stated that she feared if she said something to disrupt his football career, he would kill her. You'll have to read the whole article to make up your own mind, but it makes a good case that despite Holder's reluctance to testify and some inconsistencies in her story, there are much bigger problems with the various stories that football player Hardy told. This wouldn't be a standout story. It would be sadly normal, just like yet another domestic shooting, if it was between two ordinary people. But it illustrates how the treatment of assault, which was not sexual in this case, appears to be heavily influenced by the man's prominence and importance to society, financial importance to society. Will Hardy, now that he's been given a second chance, learn a lesson, or will he end up killing somebody one day? But just in case you think I've gone all politically correct on you, and I never question these stories, here's another story in the Toronto Star on November the 6th about Mark Kane, Patrick Kane, a famous bad boy hockey player. This appears to be the opposite case, according to the Toronto Star, which is a very liberal newspaper in Canada. So if they're publishing it, it's probably being pretty well vetted, because this is not what I'm sure they'd like to publish. Kane, the hockey player, was probably innocent, and although he technically got off in court, the newspaper says he was basically convicted in the court of public opinion. Patrick Kane is admittedly a bad boy hockey player, famous for drinking, carousing, at one time accused of punching a taxi driver in the nose. What is it with Canadians and taxi drivers? So when he was accused of rape, it didn't seem surprising. Many people believed it without any evidence. Some were upset when the case was dropped. But the Toronto Star article makes a good case that this was the right decision. Not just uncertainty, but a probability that the rape never happened. This is a quote from the newspaper article. Few women falsely cry rape, but some do for a variety of unpalatable reasons, from revenge to extortion. Academic studies analyzing crime records consistently conclude that provably false rape allegations occur at a rate of 2 to 10%. That's a huge swing margin, but it should also be noted that provably false means ironclad. Now, this is really interesting. Not only is this a liberal newspaper, but this article is written by a woman. What she's emphasizing is that when people say the rate of false rape allegations is only 2 to 10%, which, by the way, I don't see as a small problem, considering the significance of what happens to somebody who is falsely convicted of rape, they're saying that these are provably false. In the case of a he said, she said, yes, we had sex, and he says it was consensual, and she says it wasn't. That's not provably false. In those cases, it usually boils down to who the judge feels is more credible. So what she's saying is, in actual fact, the rate of false allegations of rape may be greater than the 2 to 10%. Anyway, to continue with the article, Kane's accuser has not recanted. She has stated that she no longer wishes to pursue a criminal prosecution and will not cooperate further in a matter which the district attorney now describes as rife with reasonable doubt. DNA tests, according to the district attorney, lend no corroboration whatsoever to the complainant's claim of penetration, a required element of proof for a rape charge. Kane's DNA was not present on the woman's genital area or in her undergarments, though it was found on the woman's shoulders and fingernails. This is strongly suggestive that Kane had no sexual contact with his accuser. Everyone agrees that she was present in his house on the night in question. There was also none of Cain's DNA retrieved from the bed on which the woman said the rape was committed. Rape certainly happens commonly. It's a big problem, but we must never lose sight of the principle that everyone is innocent until proven guilty. Even bad boy hockey players are not guilty of everything that they are accused of. Staying on the topic of sex and the justice system, two of my favorite topics, the Toronto Star also has an article on a sexting scandal in a Colorado high school. And I think this was carried by a number of newspapers. Students at Cannon City High School in Colorado, in fact as young as eighth graders, have been caught exchanging sexually explicit photos. The Fremont County DA said that some children could face child pornography charges that cause them to register as sex offenders. Police Captain Jim Cox says authorities don't want victims to think they did something wrong, but authorities want to know what happened. The problem is that teen and preteen children have always been interested in sex, in the body parts of the opposite sex, in every aspect of sex. This, of course, varies with the child, and some children develop this interest earlier, some later. In a case like this, you could have children who both allowed themselves to be photographed and shared photos of themselves and others, so they would be both victims and perpetrators. Could someone even be convicted of pedophilia for transmitting an explicit photo of themselves? I guess I'm joking about this, but couldn't the high school just bring the children and their parents in, talk to them about what they've done, and give parental and high school punishments? Criminalization of stuff like this, which, you know, prior to the age of smartphones, would have been done using other mechanisms, could destroy children's lives, making it impossible for them to finish high school, let alone lead a fulfilling life and contribute to society. Imagine it's 1950 and some children are caught exchanging photos they've torn out of their dad's cache of Playboy magazines. Would we really have them tarred for life as sex offenders? I remember one time when I was very young, 12, 13, something like that, when I and two friends slept out in the backyard in a tent. One of my friends had brought some Playboy magazines, which I guess he'd taken out of his dad's stash, which I was kind of interested in, although I was a bit young to get fully turned on by sexual content. Then the friend, who was the oldest and the most delinquent, decided to show us how big his penis was and masturbated in front of us. It was educational to me, since I'd never seen anything like that. But what if I'd taken a picture and it was 2015 and he was younger than me rather than older? I could have been tarred for life as a sex offender, or maybe he could have been tarred for life as a sex offender. It seems that children need to explore their sexuality safely, and threatening to criminalize when they take a picture of their body parts or a friend's body parts doesn't seem right. That's not to say that we should say that it's perfectly okay to do things like that, but surely there are better ways to deal with those kinds of things than giving children a lifetime criminal record. Well, now for something a little bit lighter. In Yale, before Halloween, the Intercultural Affairs Committee sent around an email warning about thoughtless and insensitive Halloween costumes. Examples they give are, quote, wearing feathered headdresses, turbans, wearing war paint, or modifying skin tone, or wearing blackface or redface. These same issues and examples of cultural appropriation and or misrepresentations are increasingly surfacing with representations of Asians and Latinos. Yale is a community that values free expression as well as inclusivity, and while students definitely have a right to express themselves, we would hope that people would actively avoid these circumstances that threaten our sense of community or disrespect, alienate or ridicule segments of our population based on race, nationality, religious belief, or gender expression. In many cases, the student wearing the costume is not intended to offend, but their actions or lack of forethought have sent a far greater message than any apology could after the fact. End of quote. Well, that memo is a bit nanny state, but it's probably true that dressing up as the KKK, as one mayor's wife did in Oklahoma, I think, this Halloween, or dressing up as Adolf Hitler with a concentration camp victim, or dressing up as a white slave master with a black slave, these things would probably offend and shock a lot of people, rightly so. While dressing up as a stereotypical Indian or black minstrel might not seem so bad, it all does seem to depend on the intent of the person dressing up. If you dress as Hitler to mock him, that's different from not understanding the cultural context, or doing it deliberately to assert your free speech right to shock and offend people. But how do you tell why somebody has dressed up? I remember the moving Blazing Saddles, where the hero and his black sidekick dress up in a KKK costume to escape the bad guys. And the problem is that when they go to sign the oath of fealty to the KKK, when a black hand comes out of the white costume, obviously a chase ensues, and it's all very funny. Clearly, that was people dressing up as the KKK to mock them in a movie, not to laud the KKK as a respectable organization. But in any case, there wasn't anything terribly wrong with this memo. But the associate master of Silliman College, Erica Christakis, wrote a letter in which she also included her husband, Nicholas, as a supporter, and a number of students, saying, quote, "I've always found Halloween an interesting embodiment of more general adult worries about young people. I was speaking with some of my students yesterday about the ways in which Halloween, traditionally a day of subversion for children and young people, is also an occasion for adults to exert their control. This year, we seem afraid that college students are unable to decide how to dress themselves on Halloween." She gives an example of a blonde-haired child who wants to dress as a Disney Chinese princess Mulan, or Tiana, the frog princess, which is a black Disney heroine. She quotes her husband Nicholas as saying, "If you don't like a costume someone is wearing, look away or tell them you are offended. Talk to each other. Free speech and the ability to tolerate offense are the hallmarks of a free and open society." I think she makes a good case. And it would have ended there if more than 740 Yale students, faculty, alumni, and outsiders hadn't signed an open letter to Christakis telling her that if her email was offensive because it invalidates the voices of minority students. Christakis invited all the signatories within her college. The master of a college at Yale is a couple who basically look after the social needs of the students who live in that college. One student rejected this offer of lunch, saying that Nicholas Christakis, quote, "needs to stop instigating more debate." Wow, just think about that. We got to stop debate on this. Later, about 100 students gathered in Silliman College courtyard, and this was caught on video, of course, and Nicholas bravely went out to meet them. He engaged with the angry students for several hours without losing his cool, but also refused to apologize for the statement, "I stand behind free speech. I defend the right for people to speak their minds." Then the word safe space came up, the students saying, "Our college, Silliman College, which is a residential college where they live, Silliman College should be a safe space. We shouldn't be confronted with uncomfortable intellectual beliefs." In my opinion, neither of the two letters was really a problem. The original letter was a bit patriarchal and heavy-handed, but it didn't demand conformance. And the Christakis letter illustrated a valid alternative opinion. The problem is that this is all a virtual discussion. If there was a costume that was deemed offensive by some, then there would be something to argue about. Would a Donald Trump imitation be offensive to some people? What about an Obama or Ben Carson in blackface? Or Hitler, Pol Pot, Genghis Khan, General Custer? The problem is that if you assert absolute freedom of speech, then somebody will come up with a costume that will offend even you. But if you start prescribing costumes, then pretty soon there will be little boys and girls all over the world crying their eyes out because their favorite movie hero or heroine is the wrong skin color, and it's culturally inappropriate for an 8 or 9 year old boy or girl to dress up as that person. But it's kind of ironic that if we want to talk about cultural appropriation, we're talking about Disney characters, because of course the Walt Disney Company has developed many of their characters through cultural appropriation of folktales. A similar events in some ways occurred at the much less privileged University of Missouri, now referred to as UMIS. It used to be referred to as Ole Miss, which was the term slaves used to call their owners' wives. Maybe just a coincidence, maybe just emphasizing that in Missouri, the whites were in control. This university is in part of the southern part of the United States, surrounded by memories of the United States' southern racist history. Recently, there have been a number of racist events, including a swastika smeared in feces on a dorm wall. The president was slow to respond and drove away from a group of activists at a parade, even hitting some of them, although I don't believe anybody was injured. After months of student protests, the football team, largely black, went on strike, and they were supported by their football coach, who I believe is the highest paid member of staff at the university. Faced with the loss of $1 million for losing one game, the president, Tim Wolf, resigned. This was not a memo from a university describing forbidden actions and symbols like happened at Yale. This was a reaction to real events. According to Dave Zirin in The Nation, Wolf wanted to run the university like a tech company, which apparently meant slashing health insurance subsidies, raising tuition, and spending $76 million on improvements to the football stadium, and himself getting paid almost $500,000 a year, although that's only a minor percentage of what was paid to the football coach. This case does illustrate that there do need to be limits of speech, even in a so-called free society. Is there anyone who would defend a swastika created from feces as legitimate speech? The demands of the students who called themselves the 1950 group, referring to the first year that the University of Missouri allowed black students, were a strange mixture of very intelligent demands, very cogent demands, and things like demand number one. We demand that the University of Missouri System President Tim Wolf writes a handwritten apology to the concerned student 1950 demonstrators and holds a press conference in the Mizzou Student Center reading the letter. In the letter and at the press conference, Tim Wolf must acknowledge his white male privilege, recognize that systems of oppression exist, and provide a verbal commitment to fulfilling concerned student 1950 demands. He must admit his gross negligence, allowing his driver to hit one of the demonstrators, consenting to the physical violence of bystanders, and lastly, refusing to intervene when Columbia Police Department used excessive force with demonstrators. This, I think, is overly specific and rather naive, because it's quite clear that a man in a position of such privilege as the president of a university would much rather resign than humiliate himself by doing what they demand. So it's all kind of pointless, especially when the second demand is the immediate removal of Tim Wolf as the University of Missouri System President. On the other hand, demand number five is, we demand that by the academic year 2017-2018, the University of Missouri increase the percentage of black faculty and staff campus-wide to 10%, which is somewhat closer to the percentage of blacks in the state of Missouri. This seems to be a completely reasonable demand. The percentage of black staff at the university is much lower than in the population at large, and it is reasonable, in my opinion, to try to change that. Some of the other demands are well-intentioned, but you wonder how they could ever be monitored. For example, we demand that the University of Missouri creates and enforces comprehensive racial awareness and inclusion curriculum throughout all campus departments and units, mandatory for all students, faculty, staff, and administration. The curriculum must be vetted, maintained, and overseen by a board comprised of students, staff, and faculty of color. It doesn't seem reasonable that only people of color should be in charge of creating this curriculum. One would think that it would cover issues other than skin color, such as sexuality. There may be also women who feel that they're not getting a fair shake at the university. But putting that aside, if the idea is to get into the hearts and minds of people who grew up with racist, misogynist, homophobic ideas, it's not clear that any curriculum is ever going to change the mind of an 18-year-old who's already had 18 years of thinking of things in one way. But you can't do nothing. The question is, how do you know when this demand has been achieved? You could fight over what this curriculum should be for many years. Similarly, the university should compose a strategic 10-year plan to increase retention rates for marginalized students, sustain diversity curriculum and training, and promote a more safe and inclusive campus. Well, you can measure the retention rate for marginalized students, assuming everybody can agree what a marginalized student is, but the other aspects are much more difficult to monitor and to determine whether you've been successful or not. I think there was a lot of sympathy for the MISU demands. Nobody felt too bad for the president of the Missouri University of Missouri system president, Tim Wolf, when he had to resign. But one of the commonalities in both Yale and Mizzou was this idea of safe spaces. While it's clear that universities should be physically safe spaces, and that does take some special considerations because you have a large group of young people experiencing freedom from their parents' control, often for the first time in their life, experimenting with alcohol, sex, drugs, bad things can happen. Physical safety should be assured as much as possible, but that doesn't mean that the university should be safe from challenging the viewpoints of students. There should not be intellectual safe spaces, or at least not in the public parts of the university. If you want to get away from uncomfortable discussions, you can always go to a private space, such as your dorm room. I don't know if anybody's actually defined exactly what safe spaces mean, but it seems to mean that it's a place where viewpoints will not be challenged. And I think that's singularly inappropriate for a university. Even someone who wraps up all the minorities in one person, such as an LGBT or Q woman of color, should not be immune from being challenged on her viewpoints. Respectfully challenged, without shouting, belittling, or physical violence, obviously. But still, everybody should be open to being challenged. The safe spaces concept led to things going sideways at MISU. When the president resigned, which was one of the demands of the students of color and their supporters, reporters flooded the encampment of students in a public space in the center of the campus. Then, led by Professor Melissa Clark, they physically blocked the reporters from interviewing any of the students. Captured on video was the blocking of an Asian American student journalist working for ESPN. This was to make the encampment a, quote, safe space. Having asserted their free speech rights to camp in the middle of campus in protest, they now wanted to block the free speech rights of the press while in a public space. Admittedly, the press had ignored the protest until the football team went on strike, causing the president's resignation, which says a lot about the relative importance of minority rights versus highly profitable college sports. And the press were probably largely white and male, although the Asian American student, of course, didn't fit that mold totally. This action was clearly wrong and a strategic. But shortly after this, Professor Melissa Clark surprised everyone by having the guts to say that she was wrong and apologize. This is what she wrote. Yesterday was an historic day at MU, full of emotion and confusion. I have reviewed and reflected upon the video of me that is circulating, and have written a statement to offer both apology and context for my actions. I have reached out to the journalists involved to offer my sincere apologies and to express regret over my actions. I regret the language and strategies I used, and sincerely apologize to the MU campus community and journalists at large for my behavior, and also for the way my actions have shifted attention away from the students' campaign for justice. From this experience, I have learned about humanity and humility. When I apologized to one of the reporters in a phone call this afternoon, he accepted my apology. I believe he's doing a difficult job, and I'm glad to have had the experience to speak with him, the opportunity to speak with him. His dignity also spoke well to the journalism program at MU. Again, I wish to express my sincere apology for my actions on Curriculum Quad yesterday. And that should have been it, but it seems that people who are being made uncomfortable when students of color, other groups of students assert their rights, it's almost as if this apology never happened because people are still talking about it and nobody on the other side appears to be in a mood to forgive somebody who in the heat of the moment did something that she later admitted was wrong. I hope that some of the students at Yale will eventually offer a similar apology. I remember when I was at university, I thought that it was the hardest thing I'd ever done. I think a lot of it was just due to my lack of organization when it came to my schoolwork. I was always stressed out. But then when I actually left university and started to work, I realized I was actually working a lot harder and more concerted hours than I had ever worked at university. So people who have this feeling that university students actually have it pretty easy compared to those who have to work for a living, I'm not sure they're going to be too supportive of the kinds of statements of demands coming out of Ms. Yu. And now there's one out of Amherst College, which at first I thought was a parody. Here's their first demand. President Martin must issue a statement of apology to students, alumni, and former students, faculty, administration, and staff who have been victims of several injustices, including but not limited to our institutional legacy of white supremacy, colonialism, anti-black racism, anti-Latinx racism, anti-Native American racism, anti-Native slash indigenous racism, anti-Asian racism, anti-Middle Eastern racism, heterosexism, cissexism, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, ableism, mental health stigma, and classism. Also include that marginalized communities and their allies should feel safe at Amherst College. Number four, President Martin must issue a statement of apology to faculty, staff, and administrators of color, as well as their allies, neither of whom, it obviously should be none of whom, were provided a safe space for them to thrive while at Amherst College. There's that safe space thing again. Number five, President Martin must issue a statement to Amherst College community at large that states, we do not tolerate the actions of students who posted the All Lives Matters posters and the, quote, free speech posters that stated that in memoriam to the true victim of the Missouri protests, free speech. Also let the student body know that it was racially insensitive to the students of color on our college campus and beyond who are victim to racial and harassment and death threats. Alert them that student affairs may require them to go through the disciplinary process if a formal complaint is filed, and that they will be required to attend extensive training for cultural and racial competency. President Martin must issue a statement of support for the revision of the Honor Code to reflect a zero-tolerance policy for racial insensitivity and hate speech. I can understand the hate speech, but how do you define racial insensitivity? I think it's really good that students who don't fit into the main mold of the students of the United States or other countries are asserting their right to be treated better, but it can't be taken to the point where they're suppressing free speech and reacting to potentially imaginary slights. There has to be some common sense that comes in, and I hope that instead of two opposites getting further and further apart, there will be an attempt for people to get closer together and to resolve some of these issues. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Infectious Myth. I'll talk to you next week.